Chapter 13, Mansfield, Ohio, 2000 to 2005. Julie was an elementary school teacher and, like most teachers, had summers off. I arrived in Mansfield at the end of May. She encouraged me to take the summer off with her. It took very little encouragement. I had enough money to get by for a while and wasn't that eager to find a job. Seemed like a great idea at the time. I enjoyed this kind of transition. Take 3 months to settle in, explore the new surroundings, and have a little fun with Julie. I got along well with Julie's daughter. She was, like most good-looking high school seniors, a little self-absorbed, excited about graduating, and looking forward to her upcoming college life. Julie and I got along very well, too. We didn't exactly pick up where we left off in high school, because neither of us could remember where that was. But for the moment, we had an idyllic relationship. As the summer came to a close, I became a little anxious about finding a job. Perhaps it wouldn't be as easy as I thought it would be. Despite the fact that I had a wealth of experience, I was close to 50, not in the best of health, no degree, no specialized education, and was licensed for nothing more than driving a car. As I had done so many times before, I scanned the want ads and searched the internet for employment opportunities. Nothing. Worst case scenario, I could fall back on upper-level retail management. I sent my resume to a few headhunters. I heard nothing. Perhaps I was too old. I couldn't prove age discrimination. Nonetheless, no one responded. After a month of inaction, my anxiety increased while my bank account decreased. I'd been a warehouse member for years. First it was BJ's, then Costco's, and lastly Sam's. Of the three, I thought Costco's was the best. I think maybe it was the lighting. In Mansfield, there was little choice. I would work at Sam's Club. I saw an ad in the paper. Sam's was hiring, so I filled out an application and was interviewed within a few days. I assumed that because of my vast managerial experience, starting out as one of its crew managers was about as low as they would place me. Ha ha. The position they hired me for was cashier at $10 an hour. Take it or leave it. I took it. The older I got, the more I had to swallow my pride, mostly because I found myself working for people much younger than I was, and not nearly as smart. Well, younger anyway. This was certainly the case at Sam's. Although the ages of my fellow cashiers were close to mine, the crew managers all looked to be in their late teens and early 20s. I did my best to ignore them, because doing otherwise pissed me off. It was not that they didn't do a fine job or ever gave me a hard time about anything. It's just that they were much younger and made more money than I did. I was told that all Sam employees started as cashiers. What I saw was that most of them remained there. The job was simple but strenuous, way too much lifting and bending. Otherwise, I was a very friendly and efficient cashier. I didn't like the work, but felt there were no alternatives. After I was there for 6 months, which was getting close to my tolerance level, a spot opened up in the fresh foods department for a meat cutter. I like meat. I've always liked meat. Sometimes when I have dinner, I like to have a little meat to go along with my meat. It was a lateral move. No increase in salary, but also no more long lines of customers with carts and flatbeds overflowing with enough food and supplies to stock a fallout shelter. Meat cutters at Sam's cut very little meat. The job entailed stocking the display coolers with fresh meat, chicken, and fish. Working in this department was a welcome relief from cashiering. Only two of us worked any shift, so we were somewhat autonomous. One of my co-workers had a great system for packaging stew meat. He would take a few of the ends from the steak tenderloins, at least 3 pounds worth, cut them into cubes, package them, and price them as stew meat. Then I would buy this 3-pound package before the store closed. Julie and I really loved the filet mignon kebabs we made. We'd start off by skewering a cube of beef, followed by another cube of beef, followed by another cube of beef, and so on and so forth. We didn't screw up the flavor with any vegetables. I'm happy to say that by the time I left Sam's, I had not cut off any fingers or sold anyone out-of-date meat. I left because I had the goofy notion that commanding an over-the-road semi-tractor trailer couldn't be much more difficult than driving an Air Force tarmac taxi, a Westlake cab, a stretch limo, a septic tank truck, or a school bus. I didn't grow up wanting to be a cowboy, firefighter, cop, or doctor, much less a truck driver. In fact, I'm still not sure what I want to be when I grow up. While cutting pork chops, trimming steaks, and thawing chicken for Sam's Club members, my mind drifted and took a sharp detour to the over-the-road trucking industry. I had never driven a semi-tractor trailer, but as I had concluded so many times before when considering a major career shift, how tough could it be? I considered the pros and cons, not spending nearly enough time on the latter. I had great instincts, but you know that by now. Surely there was no need to spend a lot of time researching over-the-road trucking as a job. I listed all the great things that would come my way in this new world. I would be on my own most of the time. I would not have one soul to manage. I could work it out so that I would be gone during the week and home on the weekends. I'd be paid well upon starting. I could explore parts of the country and consume new snack foods. I would learn how to use a CB radio. Already I was trying to think of what my handle might be. I wanted something catchy like Squatty Body, Tidy Trucker, Spare Tire, or the Grim Sleeper. I found out from a classified ad that Schneider Trucking was looking for a few good driver candidates. It would provide paid training that included obtaining a commercial driver's license, a CDL. In exchange for this largesse, trainees were expected to drive for Schneider for at least 1 year. This sounded better all the time. Of course, after I started driving, I found out that the per-mile rate that Schneider paid was approximately 15 cents less than any of the other trucking companies. This may not sound like much until you started adding up thousands of miles a week. I applied, went in for the interview, managed to not screw up, and ended up getting the job. Given that I was 54 years old, that should give you some idea of how desperate Schneider was. But then, I was counting on that. I gave Sam's 2 weeks' notice, packed my bags, and headed off to Schneider University, 20 miles from Mansfield, for 2 weeks of training. The classroom instruction, though necessary, was incredibly boring. The driving instruction was fun, only when I got to see my classmates screw up. I had an advantage. I already knew how to double clutch from my days at Rose Septic Tank Service. Who would have thought that shit would have come in handy? My instructors were impressed with the double clutching. I didn't tell them where I acquired the skill. And when it came to tooling around parking lots and relatively deserted country roads, I had no fear of handling the big rig. This attitude may be characterized as hubris. The memorization and technical skills required to pass the CDL were manageable. I had to go through a 40-point checklist around the truck and inside the cab before I could turn the key. If I missed a few of these items, I would fail the test. The driving test was a little nerve-wracking. When I'd taken my driving test as a teenager, passing or failing only had social and emotional ramifications. With the CDL test, my livelihood was at stake. I reminded myself, if I don't pass this test, I have no idea what I'm going to do for a living. Fortunately, I passed. Giving the news to Julie was not nearly as much fun as announcing a promotion or a big raise. This was more like telling her that her worst fears were finally realized. Hi, honey. I passed. I'm a trucker. I spent the next 2 weeks riding and learning from Mickey, a veteran trucker. He was a great guy, a good teacher, fearless, and he actually looked a little like Mickey Rooney. We got through the 2 weeks without incident, and he approved me for the mission ahead. My contract with Schneider called for me to deliver full loads of Budweiser, Monday through Friday, to Michigan, Wisconsin, and West Virginia. Naturally, until I knew better, I thought this was pretty cool. My first day was like jumping into cold water. The Budweiser bottling plant was in Columbus, Ohio, 40 miles west of Mansfield. I was told to report at 6 in the morning. I walked into the small dispatch room and joined 6 or 7 other drivers waiting for assignment. I introduced myself. The dispatcher located my name on the computer. He hit the print button, and my manifest spit out of the printer. I told him this was my first run. Ever. Unimpressed, he said, "Yeah, that's cool, Tidyman. You'll do fine. Your trailer is number 407. It's at the south end of the yard. Stop at the security gate before you leave to have them put on your rear door security seal. Call me as soon as you're done unloading in Michigan. Next." I approached my first over-the-road run with a little anxiety. Actually, a lot. My truck, with trailer, was more than 70 feet long. Loaded, it weighed 78,000 pounds. I left the dispatch station, jumped into my bobtail tractor, and headed out to the yard to find my trailer loaded with the King of Beers. I found the trailer, pulled up to it. I slowly backed up until I had my turntable lined up exactly with the kingpin under the trailer. Then, while still in reverse, I punched the accelerator hard enough to engage and lock the trailer. This went so well, I was momentarily buoyed with confidence. After the trailer was connected, I went around to the back, opened it, and climbed in. Even for a non-beer drinker, this was an amazing sight. As far as my eyes could see, from floor to ceiling, was more beer than I could ever drink in a lifetime. I picked up a couple of expander keeper clamps. They spanned one interior wall to the other and were used to secure the rear skids of beer. One went near the top third of the wall of beer, one went on the bottom third. Load secured, I jumped out. I walked around the side of the truck, found the handle used to raise the steel support wheels, and locked them in place. Next, I jumped between the front of the trailer and the rear of the cab and hooked up the air brakes. With the engine running, I turned on all the lights and walked around the truck to make sure they all worked. Then I checked the tire inflation. I jumped into the cab, went through the rest of the checklist, pulled out my manifest, and started to map my trip. Remember, this was before GPS. Once done, I headed to the front gate to have the security seal attached to the rear doors. The seal would not be broken until I reached my destination. Then I pulled up to the scale. The load limit for the trailer on the interstate was 80,000 pounds, usually measured from front wheels of the trailer. Because of the weight distribution in the trailer, heavier in the front of the trailer, it was possible to look as if you weighed more than what you were actually carrying. If that was the case, the driver had to adjust the tandems. The rear wheels on the trailer, tandems, are mounted on an adjustable slide. The objective was to distribute the weight evenly on the front and rear wheels in order to get an accurate reading on the scale. In this case, I was carrying 78,000 pounds, but the scale read 81,000. I had to slide my tandems forward. Shit. A large steel handle was mounted on the tandem slide beneath the trailer. Because these handles were exposed to weather, every one of them, on every trailer, especially in the snow belt, was a rusted, crusty, immovable piece of shit. This one was no exception. Once I released the handle, I began the next really ridiculous procedure of sliding the trailer forward or backward. I jumped into the cab, set the rear brakes, put the truck in reverse, and popped the clutch. The truck lurched backwards while the tandems, brakes still applied, remained stationary. In the CDL class, we were given a formula for doing this. Each hole on the tandem rail equaled a displacement of 500 pounds, or something like that. This was bullshit. Adjusting the tandems called for sound guesswork. If the driver didn't move the tandems enough, the scale would tell him his truck was still overweight. Moving the tandems too far could put undue stress on the turntable kingpin link and might bend it, or the driver could end up with an unbalanced load. If you didn't do it just right, you had to start from the beginning. If you did do it right, you were free to hit the road. The first stop was to fuel up. After the tanks were topped off, it was time to sit back, relax, and enjoy the ride. After spending a week delivering beer to Michigan, Wisconsin, and West Virginia, I realized I had made a disastrous mistake, one that I would have to live with for quite a while. I realized in a fairly short period of time that it took a special kind of person to be a truck driver. I was not it. I will always respect truck drivers. I had discovered quickly that driving a truck was by far the most grueling job, mentally and physically, that I had ever had. My health was suffering. The physical exertion, lousy nutrition on the road, sleeping in the truck, and sitting at the wheel for so many hours a day were going to shorten my already threatened life expectancy. I was always anxious about potential accidents, getting lost, and the danger I posed to other drivers, truckers, and non-truckers. And this was just my first week. I can remember walking back to my truck after taking a break at a rest stop. I stared at it from nose to tail and marveled at its overall size. I said to myself, "Are you nuts? Look at the size of that thing." At the same time, I wonder what made me think applying for this job was a smart move. By now, I had little choice but to climb in and keep on trucking. I didn't screw up every day, but I did screw up a lot. For the sake of brevity, I will list my faux pas in chronological order, leaving out thousands of mishap-free miles. One day, I headed south out of Wisconsin with an empty trailer. I was lost. I kept thinking that if I drove long enough, I would run into something familiar, like the interstate. After an anxious hour and a half of this genius logic, I pulled to the side of the road to check the map. Although I was practically blinded by frustration with my overall life, I finally figured out that I was driving in the wrong direction. All I needed to do was turn around and head back the other way for 20 miles, and I'd pick up the interstate. Note, the truck was 70 feet long. I couldn't just turn it around anywhere. Finally, I spotted a business parking lot. It looked as though there were plenty of spaces between the lampposts and islands for me to accomplish this. I eased the monster in, slowly rolled back towards the back of the lot, made my turn, and slowly headed out. Ta-da! I was back on the road. An hour later, the distress signal started flashing on my communication system. It was the code that meant I had to call my dispatcher. It took me an hour to find a payphone in a huge parking lot. No cell phones yet. Here's the transcript. Tidyman, where the fuck are you? I just stepped out of my truck to call you. I think I'm somewhere in Wisconsin. No shit. Did you pull through a medical building parking lot an hour ago to turn around? Because they have your numbered trailer and your truck number. Okay, I thought. If he already knew all that, why the hell did he ask? Was he worried that my truck had been hijacked? Yeah, why are you asking? Because there's an all-points bulletin out for you right now for a hit and run. No shit. What did I hit? Notice I didn't say who. You level some shrubs and a 30-foot lamppost. Wow, you're kidding. No, I'm not kidding. What the fuck are you doing? Hey, I was turning the truck around. Apparently I misjudged the turn and took a few things out. You know, these trucks are pretty big. It's not always obvious what you run over 70 feet behind you. God damn it, get that truck back in here and report to me as soon as you do. I almost said, Chris, that's what I was doing before you made me stop for this phone call. The damage, $6,000, was paid by Schneider's Insurance. I ended up with a $50 ticket and a couple of points on my CDL. I had to spend 4 hours with an instructor driving around Columbus, making tight turns without hitting anything before I got my truck back. One Friday, I was taking a load of liquid gold to West by God, Virginia. I wanted to be on the road early enough to drop the load and head back to Columbus later that night. The highway was clear, but if you've had the joy of driving 200 miles of hairpin West Virginia mountain roads hauling a 78,000-pound load, you can expect slow going and endless downshifting. By the time I got into the town where the beer distribution warehouse was, it was still light outside, but not by much. I had never driven to this warehouse before, and I'm not all that good with directions. West Virginia roads are enough to challenge even a skilled truck navigator. They are narrow, they switch direction every 100 yards, and street and route signs are optional. Just 30 minutes earlier, I had talked to the warehouse manager. He said he would be waiting in front of the parking lot to flag me down. At that point, I knew that I had to turn around again. As I said, turning a tractor trailer around was a bitch in the best of situations. In the hills of West Virginia, it was damn near impossible. I had no choice but to keep driving until I found a spot big enough to turn around. In this case, it took hours. I would come to a dead end with no place to turn around. This was a narrow two-lane road, no shoulder, and forest for as far as I could see on either side. The company would have to call in a helicopter crane to pluck me out. Or, same scenario, but the dead end is from a scene in Deliverance. First, of course, these redneck hillbilly, soon-to-be fornicators and sodomizers, would get rip-roaring drunk on my 78,000-pound load of Budweiser. I was also driving myself crazy with this mental refrain. What the fuck am I doing out here? I have to quit this job before I die, get killed, kill someone, or all of the above. The fuck was I thinking? Oh, sure, how tough could it be to drive a truck? Finally, two guys in a pickup truck pulled onto the road in front of me. I flashed my lights, beeped, and yanked on the cord for the air horn. After I finally got their attention, they pulled over. I hopped down from the cab, walked to their open window, explained my desperate situation, and asked, "Where can I turn around?" Oddly enough, just a half mile up the road was a huge parking lot of an out-of-business Home Depot. Even though there was no threat, implied or otherwise, they should have been rewarded with a couple of cases of beer for this gold nugget of information. 4 hours after I got into this small town and talked to the warehouse manager, I found the place and pulled into the lot. Although the warehouse manager didn't say anything, he must have thought that Budweiser and Schneider were really scraping the bottom of the barrel when they hired me. We unloaded the Budweiser the next morning. Over the next 6 months, I had many more adventures. I got lost in Southside Chicago. Very scary. I almost took out the top of my truck or the bottom of a railroad bridge in the same part of town. It reminded me of Boston. In Wisconsin, I hung the trailer up on a snowbank in a parking lot while attempting to turn around. A guy in a Ford 350 with some towing straps pulled me free. While trying to leave a distribution warehouse in southern Ohio, I hung the rear wheels of the trailer up on some 6-foot boulders. They were there to mark the turn. Maybe they should have been painted fluorescent orange. I had to wait for one of those heavy-duty tow trucks to get me out of that one. By now, I'd been with Schneider for 8 months. I still didn't have a CB handle and really didn't want one. Although I very rarely turned the CB radio on, I could appreciate the benefit of the CB radios. I thought they were essential for communication, safety, entertainment, humor, developing a sense of identity, helping each other out, or otherwise having the ability to commiserate on those long, lonely drives. So out of sheer desperation one day, I turned on the truck CB. The usual chatter was filtering through, like one trucker telling another trucker something vitally important, such as, "Hey, Walmart, you see that sumbitch driving the Twinkie truck with his retreads on the right rear spitting out all over the place? Yeah, what the fuck, over?" Then all of a sudden, coming in loud and clear over my CB, I heard someone yelling at me, "Hey, Schneider, get in your goddamn lane!" I quickly got back into my lane and then just as quickly turned the CB off. I didn't find it all that entertaining or useful after all. As one of the new guys at Schneider, I drove one of the older, shittier trucks. I drove what's called a cab over, meaning the cab is directly over the engine. You can still see some of these driver death traps on the road, distinguished by their windshields being on the same plane as the front bumper. This placed the driver's body, in this case mine, 3 feet from the impact area in the event of a head-first impact. In addition, this rolling piece of rusted steel probably had a few million miles on it. The shocks were shot, as were the pneumatics in the front seat. Unless the road was perfectly smooth, the ride was a killer. There's a stretch of state road outside Columbus that heads north towards Wisconsin. It's 30 or 40 miles of cement are broken up every 100 feet or so by a seam running across it. The drivers of most vehicles on that road would barely notice the seam. In fact, if anything, a driver might notice a slight rhythmic clicking sound as his tires passed over each one. Not so in the case of my Schneider mobile. Each seam actually bounced my seat and ass up and down an inch. Every seam for 40 miles, going to Wisconsin and coming back. Thump, bounce. Thump, bounce, thump, bounce, thump, bounce, for almost an hour in both directions. It may have been on that very stretch of highway that I decided to do something my mother and Julie advised me not to do. Do not quit a job before you have found another one. I gave Schneider 2 weeks' notice. Or did I? I was so relieved when I decided to quit, I didn't want to spend another hour or another mile behind the wheel. I wasn't worried about getting a reference from Schneider. I was the guy with the creative resume and flexible references. Julie wasn't so philosophical. First, she was pissed because I quit. Then she was relieved that her significant other was no longer a trucker. Then she was pissed because I was unemployed again. You know, with some people, you just can't win. The next week, I saw an ad in the paper. Brick stacker. $7 an hour. It turned out to be one of the few jobs I got without the benefit of interviewing, probably because the main requirement for the position was the ability to walk and talk, not necessarily at the same time. I filled out the paperwork late in the afternoon and was told to show up the next morning at 7 and to bring work gloves. Bright and early at 7 o'clock, 15 or so of us stood around outside in the middle of a brick storage area. Most of the pallet-sized stacks of bricks were laid out in a linear fashion. Every third or fourth 4-foot-high stack had been broken open, with a few of the bricks from on top strewn around the base of the pallet. Among these 15 rugged-looking workers was one rugged-looking woman. The foreman gathered around us and announced that one of us was to stay outside and restack the broken piles. In true George Costanza style, I jumped forward and volunteered. I may have given the woman a shove while trying to get past her. I didn't know what was going on inside, but I knew that working outside by myself at my own pace was going to be a damn sight better. I was right. Unfortunately, the foreman picked the woman, and the work inside really sucked. This was one of those operations where if you drove by it, you'd swear it was a deserted, run-down, out-of-business something or other. You'd be wrong. This place made the bricks. My job was to stand shoulder to shoulder with the rest of the mouth breathers and stack those bricks on a large, slanted steel conveyor. The bricks were not everyday house-building bricks. They were street pavers, which are 30% larger and equivalently heavier. As the conveyor rolled by, our job was to grab the bricks from a pile behind us, swing around, and stack them against a slanted metal wall, 10 across and 30 high. The conveyor kept running until break time and then started up again when we came back. The spotter, at the end of the line, diverted a completed wall of bricks to a pallet. I would have volunteered for the spotter's job also. For the first 10 minutes, I was able to pivot around, pick up two bricks, one in each hand, pivot back to the conveyor, and stack them on an incomplete layer of bricks. These bricks weighed at least 10 pounds each. Stacking the bricks onto the metal surface made a hell of a racket. With 13 of us in line and one lucky woman outside, it was as deafening as a stainless steel bowling alley that used stainless steel balls and pins. Despite the concentration required for this labor, I was able to observe the rest of the workforce. The guy on my left was 5 feet 10, 140 pounds of stringy muscle, stringy hair, stringy beard, and a mustache covering a mouth with an indeterminate amount of teeth. He would stack so quickly he was practically a blur. If one could be a veteran in this line of work, he was it. We didn't talk much. The guy on my right was also around 5 feet 10, backwards Pabst baseball cap covering a pile of oily hair. He looked like he weighed 280 pounds. He looked like he maintained a 7-day growth of beard. And he didn't talk much. After 10 minutes of moving two bricks at a time with two hands, I was reduced to transferring one brick at a time with two hands. My pals on either side refrained from teasing me. I thought the first 10-minute break would never arrive, and when it did, it felt like it lasted 30 seconds. I thought about quitting at lunch. Oddly enough, though, I had built up a goofy level of loyalty to the assembly line. I mean, what would they do if I walked off in the middle of the day? Who would pick up my slack? Maybe that's where the word slacker comes from. I would wait until the end of the day. I made it through lunch and slightly beyond. Then, an hour and a half later, 15 minutes before the second break, Stringy pointed toward a rail car full of bricks behind us. See that? We got to empty that load before the day is over. Swell. I took off my gloves, walked off, and headed to the office to tender my resignation. Tough work, eh? The secretary said. Tough? No. It's just not as much fun as I thought it would be. 2 weeks later, a check for $42, my wages, for the 6 hours, arrived in the mail. How much lower could it get? I had lasted 6 hours as a brick stacker. I didn't want to get morose about it, but this was not a good situation. I was in my 50s and had just quit a job of stacking bricks. Suffice it to say, this was quite a blow to my career path strategy. I was depressed for a couple of reasons. First, I had to quit because I was not physically able to do it. Second, if this job represented a last resort, what could be next? Even worse, I had to tell Julie that my career as a construction material handler had come to a quick and ugly end. I couldn't blame Julie if, by this time, she was having second thoughts about me, especially when I looked at her and said, "But, honey, I'm doing the best I can." Julie talked me into working the bingo games with her once a month for 3 months during her summer hiatus. Working the bingo games also included selling $1 game of chance cards, similar to scratch-off lottery tickets, during the bingo games and during the breaks. Julie and her fellow teachers had an arrangement with the school system. For each night they worked, they received $50 credit towards classroom supplies. She would otherwise have paid for these with her own money. When the bingo organizers were short of workers, Julie would ask me to join her. In my case, Julie paid me the $50. It was barely worth it. I could have refused, but then Julie might have said, "Oh, really? What other plans did you have tonight, Mr. Moneybags?" The games lasted 3 or 4 hours. Julie always asked nicely, and it was a great incentive for me to find a real job. On my first night, as we walked in the door, Julie assured me this was good exercise because we spent the bulk of our 3 hours walking up and down the aisles. What she didn't mention was the fact that all this healthy walking was offset by breathing through a fog bank of noxious cigarette smoke for 3 solid hours. On the positive, negative, flip side, as volunteers, we were allowed all the junk food we could eat. Maybe they should have advertised this as killer bingo. The prizes from the lottery tickets ranged from a free lottery ticket to a dollar and all the way up to $100. This was in addition to the bingo winnings. Each set of these lottery tickets was tantalizingly named something like Break the Bank or Queen of the Mountain or Easy Street. Each of us workers carried 200 tickets. We would enter the hall, sign in, put on our bingo aprons, which was similar to a nail pouch that a carpenter might wear, grab our first set of lottery tickets, $50 and change, and hit the floor. I think the idea of this additional game of chance was to give the bingo players something else to entertain and enrich themselves before and during the bingo games. It also generated quite additional cash stash for the person who owned the bingo parlor. I had worked this bingo game twice before and was still amazed, which should not have been, at how much money players would fork over for the slim chance of winning something. Nearly a dozen of us walked around selling these lottery tickets. On an average night, I sold 500 of these passports to riches. It took few brains and even less experience to sell these tickets, so I assume that the other workers were selling about the same number. That would come to almost $10,000. By Las Vegas standards, this was nothing. But this was Mansfield, Ohio, and there were only 300 people playing and buying these tickets. Again, that might not seem like a lot of money until you saw the people who were spending it. I don't think bingo has ever been an entertainment or gambling outlet for the financially well-off. This was not a good-looking crowd. By the looks of these people, you would think that one of their more challenging pastimes during the week was figuring out how to turn their food stamps into cash so they could play bingo. I wasn't raised a bigot. I don't believe I'm prejudiced or biased. I try to see the positive in any situation, and I'm positive that the last thing most of these folks should have been doing was tossing their money away on bingo and lottery tickets. But who was I to judge? They would probably think I was foolish to throw my money away on dental care, health care, nutritious food, and beer, of course. The one thing I liked about the Mansfield bingo nights was that after operating expenses were deducted, the rest of the money went to the Richland County Public Schools. This made bingo night a not-for-profit event. Who knows what the school system actually ended up with?